Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of the shakeup in Saudi Arabia, the Panama Papers, which reveal how political elites, the ultra-wealthy, and corporations like Nike and Apple use offshore tax havens to avoid paying taxes. We will also talk about the Republican tax plan. Joining us now is Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed, and one of his latest pieces is Saudi Arabia has shaken up the Middle East. This is how. Hi, Borzu. Welcome back to the show.
Future leader.
Borzu, are you with us? Hi.
Yes, I'm right. You hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Thanks for joining us, Borzu. So this shakeup is leading the news in the BBC. But before we dive in and talk about things, the news that's breaking, can you give us a little bit of background and tell us what happened? There's been a major political shakeup. Last Saturday, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered security forces to arrest some of the country's top political and business elites. Talk about why that happened.
Well, I think there's a couple, kind of very credible theories. On the one hand, you have a new king that came to power 2 years ago, who's rather old, and perhaps, like many in the Saudi ruling elite, recognizes that there needs to be some dramatic changes to Saudi Arabia in terms of the economy, in terms of the political and business culture, in terms of maybe even social norms and religion and so on. And he has, designated his very ambitious son, the Prince Mohammed bin Salman, now Crown Prince as of June, the youngest ever Crown Prince in Saudi history, 32 years old, destined to take over as a very young king compared to other Saudis. Whether that happens this year or next year or in the next 10 years, he's going to be a very young king. And he is already sort of taking charge and appears to be consolidating his power. And one way that he is doing that is going after perhaps other power bases, but also this sort of culture of corruption and largesse in the Saudi royal family, where you have these Saudi royals who basically live off of the public trough, make a lot of money, not doing a lot, get lots of sweetheart deals and government contracts and so on, and don't really contribute to the overall wealth and innovation of the country. This has created a lot of resentment among young Saudis who are not royals, where there's quite a bit of unemployment, quite a bit of resentment. And so there appears to be kind of two things happening at once. On the one hand, there's these sort of needed reforms that are happening. And on the other hand, you have this young man in a hurry.
According to The Guardian, 201 people are being held in a $100 billion corruption inquiry. According to The New York Times, that number is actually about 500 now. They've been arrested. They're being held at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And then there are reports about Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, who owns major stakes in Twitter and News Corp. He was also arrested. Between 1991 and 95, bin Talal came to the rescue of Donald Trump, whose real estate empire was in financial trouble. He purchased a yacht from Donald Trump and was part of the group that helped take the city's floundering Plaza Hotel off of Trump's hands. What about these connections?
Well, I mean, yeah, Prince Talal is a very dynamic person, and he is quite, and this is one of the confusing things, there's allegations of corruption against him as well. He's always been seen as one of the Saudi reformers, a modernizer, really good ties to Washington, really good connections to political elite around the world even. So it's, kind of confusing why he would go after someone like this. Who's not known. He's actually, if you look at WikiLeaks from the 90s, he's telling the U.S. Diplomats about corruption in Saudi Arabia, explaining to them how it works. There could be a couple things going on here. And this is all kind of informed speculation. But, Saudi's in a bit of financial trouble prosecuting this war in Yemen right now. And this could be a way of kind of getting access to some of the wealth of these Saudi royals, while at the same time kind of putting the fear of God into them as this young new crown prince rises to the scene, and at the same time changing the business and political culture of the kingdom.
Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed, and if you'd like to join us to talk about media coverage of what is happening in Saudi Arabia and this crackdown, we'll also talk a little later about the U.S. Saudi-led war on Yemen with support of the United States. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And I would also like to invite David K. Johnston to join us. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, author of many books, including The Making of Donald Trump. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be here from north of the Arctic Circle.
North of the Arctic Circle. Well, thank you for joining us, David. Mm-hmm. I wonder what your thoughts are about this crackdown in Saudi Arabia. We were just talking with Borzu about the billionaire prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, who owns major stakes in Twitter and News Corp. According to CNBC, he also has investments in 21st Century Fox, Citigroup. What are your thoughts about this well-known investor and his arrest?
Well, this would seem to be a consolidation of power by the unexpected new leader. And remember, Saudi Arabia is really not a country. It's a family business that was put together 90 years ago by a warlord who had the backing of a cleric who promoted the most extreme form we see of Islam in the world. And it's not unusual in the Middle East. Kuwait is also, I've described as a family business posing as a country. So we see that the separate, in the past, the police, the military, and another security division were all separate, and they've now all been brought together. So presumably this is what we saw Xi do in China. You remove from power anybody you think is a threat to your position, or in this case, rather than removing them from power, you arrest them, keep them in a luxury hotel, so they can't do anything to undermine your new administration.
Mm. Borzu, what would you add? Do we still have Borzu?
I would just add that, I'm still here. Yeah, I would just add that, you know, there's no one who's really challenged the Crown Prince, and there's never been a kind of precedent of challenging the Crown Prince. Even bin Talal has sworn fealty to bin Salman and has hung his portrait from one of his buildings in Riyadh. So, you know, there hasn't been anyone questioning bin Salman's rise. In many ways, there was no need to consolidate power. I think that, you know, that there might be some tough times ahead, and maybe they're trying to prepare for those tough times. There might be some broader visions of not just consolidating power and not just bringing this young, unprecedented figurehead into the leadership of Saudi Arabia, but there might be another more drastic way of transforming Saudi Arabia that is coming, that this young prince envisions, and you know, and for that reason, he's, you know, trying to transform Saudi Arabia in a hurry. But all that being said, I mean, you know, this guy doesn't appear to be, you know, you have to be really brilliant to do something like that. You know, maybe he wants to be the Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the man who transformed modern Turkey of Saudi Arabia. But there's no sign whatsoever, there's no element whatsoever that he has that kind of wisdom and that kind of experience to do something this difficult in this short of a time.
What are your thoughts, Borzu, about Donald Trump supporting what's happening on a trip to Asia? He tweeted his support, saying that some of those under arrest have been milking their country for years. He said he has, quote, great confidence in Mohammed and his father, and added, quote, they know exactly what they're doing. The Washington Post has a piece called Unlike President, Trump Administration Officials Cautious on Saudi Purge.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's quite a bit in common between Mohammed bin Salman and Donald Trump. Both are sort of members of the elite posing as populists and rallying their bases around a kind of mythical elite. And I think that in many ways, and I'm not sure about this yet, but I think maybe both of them consider themselves smarter than they are. and are kind of, you know, they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why there's so much trepidation and fear in this part of the world right now around what you know, is happening in Saudi Arabia and in the region. That includes, like, Lebanon, Iran, and so on. Is maybe these guys, there's a real feeling, a real sense of dread, is that maybe these guys in Washington, in Riyadh, in other capitals around the world and the region don't really know what they're doing.
David, CNN is also reporting, this is getting a lot of attention, that Trump asked Saudi Arabia to take its massive state-run Aramco oil company to the New York Stock Exchange if it goes public in 2018. On Saturday morning, he tweeted, quote, "Would very much appreciate Saudi Arabia doing their IPO of Aramco with the New York Stock Exchange. Important to the United States!" Exclamation point. What do you make of this, David? This would be around the value, $2 trillion.
Well, you're not going to get any Western large investors, particularly institutional ones, unless you have generally accepted accounting principles followed by the Saudi state oil company, and I don't think that's going to happen. You want to get money put into it, you can always find idiots, but institutional holders are going to insist on having generally accepted accounting principles, and there's been no indication that the Saudis are willing to submit to audits and review checking on the actual level of their reserves as opposed to what they have claimed in terms of how much oil is in the ground that's recoverable. And in the case of Donald, it's just another example of, you know, Donald just says whatever's on his mind. There's no deep strategic thinking there about what he's doing, and his ignorance, particularly of the Middle East, where he does not understand the branches of Islam. He doesn't know a Sunni from a Shia. He went to Riyadh on his first trip, and he praised the Saudis for their efforts against terrorism when they're the number one funders in the world of terrorism. It just goes to the shortcomings of Donald Trump, which are legion.
Is that any different from other presidents?
Yes, I would absolutely suggest that in Barack Obama, we had someone who took very long briefing papers, paid close attention, has demonstrated in his writings and elsewhere that he had a fairly deep understanding of issues. Even George W. Bush, after his first term, demonstrated a deeper understanding of that part of the world. Donald is in a league by himself in terms of ignorance about issues in the world, and we shouldn't normalize his not knowing things. Donald makes things up to fill in the holes where he doesn't know things.
Borzu, what are your thoughts about this? What could the real consequences of this be? I mean, how do you think Trump will affect the situation on the ground?
I think there's two things going on here. I think that, you know, you have a president who is very much in favor of supporting those people who are, he views as his kindred spirits, the Sisis, the Erdogans, the Putins, and the Bin Salman. But on the other hand, I also think there is, you know, something more deep going on here, which is a general retreat on the part of the U.S. from, kind of actively engaging in the details and nitty-gritty of the things that are going on in this part of the world. And you have all these regional powers, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, Egypt to a lesser extent, sort of scrambling to fill in the vacuum.
Today we're speaking with Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed, and David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author of The Making of Donald Trump. He's also the founder of DCReport.org. You can find information about their writings at yourcallradio.org. It is our media roundtable, and if you have any questions or comments specifically about Saudi Arabia, and then we're going to move on to the Panama Papers and taxes in a bit, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Borzu, can you also talk about the connections to Lebanon and what this means? We were just getting news from the BBC about what's happening today with Hezbollah's leader Nasrallah saying that actually, can you just give us the overview on this? Because things are moving so quickly, and I want to make sure I have my information correct.
Well, at the same time that this crackdown on the Saudi royals was going on, Saad Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, and also, by the way, a Saudi citizen who grew up in Saudi Arabia, appeared on a Saudi-owned television and announced his resignation from the post of prime minister. And now since then, things have just gotten stranger and stranger. People in Lebanon are wondering whether he made this announcement under duress and whether he has, like, freedom of mobility. Now, he was allowed to go abroad briefly to Abu Dhabi, which is the closest ally of Saudi Arabia, and then was quickly hustled back to Saudi Arabia. There are many indications from diplomats and others, including his own political party, that he's basically being under house arrest to a certain extent in Saudi Arabia. And so that's a very confusing matter. Meanwhile, you had the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, announce today that the Saudi Arabians are trying to get Israel to launch a war against Lebanon, saying that they offer them hundreds of millions of dollars to launch this war. And Nasrallah said, this is not my analysis, this is intel that I have. And that was a very, very explosive statement. It kind of shook the region again. And so once again, you have, you know, the sort of focus of many people in the world on this part of the world and whether there's going to be another war here.
So what's next? I mean, who are you talking to find out where this is going?
I mean, I talk to as many people as I can. I talk to scholars and analysts and business people who have ties or insights into the royal families of the Persian Gulf, which are famously opaque and inaccessible. I talk to scholars of the region who follow this stuff. There are, you know, officials in Lebanon and a few other countries who do talk, but maybe don't have that much information. But, you know, we really don't know where this is going next. Mm. No one has any idea. And anyone who says they know where it's going next is kind of wrong, because we're dealing with some very unpredictable characters, and we're in sort of uncharted terrain.
What are you hearing from people on the ground, Borzu? I mean, average people, how worried are they about this?
In Lebanon, they're very worried. They're very, very stressed out. I was just in Lebanon a few days. I was in Lebanon when this news broke, and you could feel it on the streets, the fear among ordinary people, taxi drivers, lawyers, you know, accountants, people who I would run into. There was a writer's conference that my wife was attending, and I met a bunch of Lebanese people there, and they were really scared. This was the talk. But in Saudi Arabia, everyone is really happy, young people especially, that these big, powerful elites are getting their comeuppance. These people who have been buying up all the Saudi land on the cheap and then sitting on it and driving up the price of housing. These people who get the plum jobs, who have the connections to get the great spots at the universities, who go abroad and drive Maseratis and so on. Finally, those people are getting a little bit of punishment for their alleged crimes and for their corruption. And so there's a real wave of support for the moves on the part of the Saudi leadership.
And before we let you go, Borzu, can you give us an update on the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which is backed by the United States? I mean, the crisis there is, it just continues to get worse. The UN says aid agencies did not know about the Saudi blockade, and Yemen's cholera epidemic has sickened more than 900,000 people.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real tragedy, and I think the really tough part for us as media is that we're not able to get into Saudi Arabia. We're not able to get into Yemen. Many, many news organizations have been dying to get into Yemen and cover what's happening there, and we're not able to access it because of the Saudi UAE blockade on media accessing most parts of Yemen. And so there's not a lot of great coverage about what's happening there. But, you know, in fact, there is this ongoing war pitting the Houthi rebels, who are to a much debatable extent backed by Iran, who toppled the UN-backed government, which is in sort of a crisis mode in another city in Yemen. And, you know, you have the Saudi Emirati offensive, mostly from the air, targeting those people in Yemen. And meanwhile, you have a very, very severe blockade of Yemen that has prevented food and trade and humanitarian supplies from getting into the country.
Mm. Well, Borzu, I know it's late there. Thank you for staying up and thank you for joining us again.
It's my pleasure.
Borzu Dargahi is Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed. And if you get a chance, a Yemeni journalist, Afran Nasser, was on Democracy Now! Earlier this week. She's the editor-in-chief of Sana'a's Review. Facing death threats, she is in exile from Yemen but continues to report on human rights violations. She's in the United States to receive the International Free Press Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. And she just gave a lot of really important information to Democracy Now! So be sure to check that out. And joining us for the rest of the hour is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author of The Making of Donald Trump. And now I would like to welcome Will Fitzgibbon to the show. Will is a reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. ICIJ and its partners have published another explosive expose of how the wealthy and elites take their money offshore so they can avoid paying taxes. You've heard about it all week. It's called the Paradise Papers. Hi, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Congratulations on the Paradise Papers. This is another explosive report 1 year right after the Panama Papers. Just a general question, Will. What are your thoughts about how the media are using the information you all exposed in the Paradise Papers?
Well, I think we've seen a whole host of really strong stories that have come not only out of the United States and the United Kingdom, where people and listeners might have heard of stories about the Queen, about Bono, about Apple, and about Nike. But this is a story, remember, that with 13.5 million documents and nearly 400 journalists working on it, has had really powerful stories in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, all across the world.
David Kaye, this is what you focus on. I mean, you won prizes for your tax reporting at the New York Times. What are your thoughts on the Paradise Papers and the overall media's reaction?
Well, I think these are very important papers for a couple of reasons. First of all, when the first Panama Papers came out, I said this won't be the last of it. There will be other hacks, and we will see stuff from other firms. There are hundreds of firms that do this kind of work. And Abby is up the feeding chain from Mossack Fonseca, the Panama firm. There were 31,000, if I recall correctly, American addresses in the files in the Paradise Papers, whereas there were very few Americans who showed up in the Mossack Fonseca files. So that the idea that, oh, Americans aren't really doing this, that had been lightly bandied about a year ago, is shown to be not so. The revelations about the corporations are particularly valuable and useful in this case. Remember, Apple had insisted, first of all, they were doing nothing wrong by taking their profits in nowhere. And, of course, there is no legislature in nowhere and therefore no taxes in nowhere. And now we know that they simply moved from their Irish and nowhere location to a new location in their continuing effort to dodge sharing in the burden of supporting the government that makes Apple's profits and success possible. And I think the news coverage of this has been more sophisticated and thoughtful than in the Panama Papers, which sort of came out of the blue to a lot of journalists. There's been a significant improvement in the quality of coverage of tax issues in the last year, I think because of the first go-round.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He extensively covers taxes, author of The Making of Donald Trump. We're also joined by Will Fitzgibbon, reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and they just came out with the explosive Paradise Papers this week. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it's our media roundtable, and we are talking about the Paradise Papers, which reveal how political elites, the ultra-wealthy, and multinationals like Nike and Apple use offshore tax havens to avoid paying taxes. We're joined today by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, author of The Making of Donald Trump, and Will Fitzgibbon, reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And they are leading this investigation with about 100 media groups, including the BBC and The Guardian. And Will, we're hearing a lot now about Applebee, not connected to Applebee's. This is the first time most of us have ever heard of Applebee. This is one of the world's largest offshore law firms. It was set up in 1898. It makes $100 million. In revenue per year annually, has more than 400 employees globally. It sets up shell companies, drafts wills, establishes trusts. Tell us more about Applebee, and when did you first learn about Applebee?
I first learned about Applebee when the data that would become the Paradise Papers was first handed over to ICIJ, which would have been around a year or a little over a year ago now. Unlike most of the world, maybe with the exception of some people like David, I had never heard of them before. But as you can imagine, with 7 million files or so from them, out of the 13.5 that comprise Panama Papers, you know, spending a year looking at them, I've certainly got a sense of their history, the kind of work that they do, and their global footprint. This, as we've said before, is a prestigious offshore law firm that provides services not only to the largest companies in the world, but some of the wealthiest people and politicians in the world. From traditional tax havens that we might think of, with palm trees and beaches in the Caribbean, to up-and-coming jurisdictions in Hong Kong, even in Shanghai, for example.
David, what would you add? Like Will said, Applebee has offices in nearly all of the world's tax havens.
Well, that goes to how they are a very, very well-developed business here. And Applebee's position from their headquarters in Bermuda is, we haven't done anything illegal. Well, that is technically true. It is not illegal in the jurisdictions they work in to, from those jurisdictions, help people commit what is tax fraud in other countries. That's absolutely no moral defense whatsoever. And operations like Applebee can be put out of business very easily by the major Western countries if they want to. For example, denying correspondent bank access to the tax haven countries where Applebee has offices, the 10 locations around the world, wouldn't totally put them out of business, but it would deeply complicate their relationships. I've in the past suggested, I was being somewhat satirical about it, but suggested that given that the Pentagon years ago took the position that tax cheating is a serious threat to the national security because it reduces resources, that we should invade the Cayman Islands, which I'm sure we could take over without firing a shot. But the governments that are being cheated by this, the major industrial governments of the world, can put a stop to this, and the only reason they're not doing it is there's no popular demand for it.
Hmm. What about that, Will? We had Kevin Hall from McClatchy on recently, who worked on the Panama Papers last year, and he said that there were calls around the world to make change and crack down on this, but not so much here in the United States. Have you all heard from any U.S. politicians about whether they will take action on this issue?
We've heard this time around a few more statements than I think we did see after the Panama Papers. That goes back to what David said previously. The Applebee law firm, quite simply, had an extraordinarily high number of U.S. clients. So logically, there would be potentially a greater U.S. interest in finding out what was going on inside that law firm and who was using it. I think as of today, we've counted responses and press releases and calls for reform from a number of Democrats. I suppose in many cases some of the Democrats you'd expect, Bernie Sanders being one of them, but also some Democrats, including Senator Whitehouse, I think, and others who were involved in ongoing legislative efforts around shell companies, offshore companies, and what's called beneficial ownership laws that would force either the states or in some kind of federal way to have a list or a register of people who own companies rather than just allowing companies to be held behind smoke screens of other people or other entities. So there have been calls for reform. You know, as someone who worked on Panama Papers and on Paradise Papers, I suppose I'm a little jaundiced about how immediate any true deep reform will be. We know as journalists that governments like to jump on bandwagons, say how wonderful the Paradise Papers is and that something needs to be done, but the role of journalists is to keep that pressure on so that promises for reform turn into actions of reform.
Appleby has also worked with people in every state in the United States. The firm's files include a who's who of the country's wealthiest citizens. We've got prominent Democrats like George Soros, Penny Pritzker, who was the Commerce Secretary in the Obama administration, Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate who supported Trump, Carl Icahn, the private equity investor who had to resign. What specifically surprised you the most, Will, when we're looking at these prominent Democrats and Republicans in the United States?
I suppose I wasn't terribly surprised to see all of those names in there. What really surprises me when you have access to millions of emails and contracts and offshore financial deeds is just how much effort all of these people and their advisors go to do things offshore and more or less in secret in a way that, I mean, quite simply never really occurs to me. I guess I simply just don't and probably never will have that money that will mean I'd ever think of spending tens of thousands of dollars on an accountant or a lawyer to help me move money around the world. So it's being able to read into that detail and contrasting that with these people's public profiles on both sides of the political aisle that I think really always surprises me.
David, do you think that the U.S. media are doing a good job of explaining why this actually matters? And over the years, I mean, I think this fact is so important. 50 years ago, for every dollar the federal government raised by taxing individuals, it got $1.50 by taxing corporations. Okay, so every dollar it got by taxing us, it got $1.50 by taxing corporations. That was 50 years ago. But today, every dollar the government gets from us, it gets only 25 cents from taxing corporations. So it's gone down by $1.25 over the last 50 years. I mean, that is a major, major decline.
It is, and it also represents the fact that under American tax law since the 1986 Tax Reform Act, multinational corporations have turned the corporate tax system into a profit center. And let me explain how they do that. It's very simple. You take money that is a profit earned here in the U.S. and should go be counted on the bottom line and taxed, and you pay it to your offshore subsidiary. It's as if you took a dollar out of your right pocket and put it in your left pocket, and in the process, you defer paying the taxes. That gets the corporation what amounts to a zero-interest loan from the government. Any tax you don't pay now that you pay in the future, that's a loan from the government of the taxes at zero interest. Well, imagine if you were able to take all the money that's been withheld from your paycheck since you started working, invest it overseas, and then when you're at retirement age, you pay the tax, but you keep all the investment income. And that's essentially what's going on here. If we had a real look at the internal books of General Electric, Apple, even Hilton Hotels, we would see that from their internal perspective, well, they report they pay taxes in various years. They actually are simply paying part of the profits they've made off delaying paying the taxes. And remember, Enron stamped the records of its tax department profit center. So fundamentally, we need to rework the rules. Now, I'm hoping a year from now to be out with my book, The Prosperity Tax, which proposes an entirely new tax system for both the U.S. and other modern countries, and it will include for the U.S. the statutory language of how to create a tax system that isn't radically different. It's just straightforward, simple, honest, and has features in it to make sure that you can't cheat unless you commit a crime.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, author of The Making of Donald Trump, and founder of DC Report. Will Fitzgibbon is a reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and they led this massive investigation looking at, or exposing, really, giving us information. It's called the Paradise Papers. And it looks at multinationals, wealthy elites, and politicians who park their money overseas so they don't have to pay taxes. And this is getting wall-to-wall media coverage. What do you think about it? Do you think the media in the U.S. are doing a good job of telling citizens why this matters and how this affects things like funding for schools, infrastructure, roads, social services, you name it? I mean, obviously there's a direct connection, but are they doing a good job of making those connections? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Will, in this country, it's almost, I don't want to say it's accepted. I think people aren't happy with what's happening, but they think, oh yeah, Apple put their money offshore. That's what they do. I mean, can you talk about the importance of this? According to the Paradise Papers, Apple sidestepped a 2013 crackdown on Irish tax practices by shopping around for a tax haven and then moved most of their untaxed cash, $252 billion, to the Channel Islands. Can you talk about how this works and why this is so important?
Well, I think to take the broader question first, I think for many people why this is so important is that we have, that we have individuals and companies in this case who seem to have it built into their DNA or have the capacity to always stay one step ahead of the game. So as you mentioned, even when governments do decide to take the decision to reform the tax system in response to scandals or simply the desire to get more tax, companies generally are always very good at finding out where the next loophole is and how they can pretty much hopscotch their way across the globe to the next tax haven that opens their arm. And that's what we saw in the Apple case. You know, there are emails in which Apple, the law firm, is discussing potential client work with Apple, and there's a spreadsheet that's sent around where Apple basically is asking, can you please advise us on potential tax rates that we'd have to pay in 6 to 7 different jurisdictions because we're considering what to do here. And once again, to put that in real life perspective, there just simply aren't that many of us that have that ability to draw up a list of 7 countries where we've never set foot in order to work out how we can manage how much money we pay to the government in which and country in which we live. So for me as a journalist reading that, and I hope through the stories that are produced on that, we convey that to the reader and the public, that this is not necessarily a normal state of affairs and that there are few people, but a few powerful people and companies that do this.
David, what would you add?
Well, first of all, you know, Will and the others who worked on this project have done phenomenal work here. Let's make sure that we don't get cynical about investigative reporting and how important it is, and recognize people who've done a really fabulous job of making all of this accessible and understandable to people. Secondly, I agree with Will that the firms that do this kind of work, like Applebee, their job is to figure out how to be ahead of the governments, but that's only because we haven't had the political will. Back in 2001, there was a movement underway by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, sometimes called the Rich Countries Club, to jointly work against tax havens. And the Bush administration sank that. And the Bush administration, I broke the story back at the beginning of the Iraq War, or shortly after the Iraq War, that the Internal Revenue Service, which is the agency that really finds both terrorist money and tax cheating money, asked for a 50% increase in its budget to go after terrorists. And we're talking, by the way, about a pittance. We're talking about $16 million. And the White House refused to approve that money on the grounds that it was too much of a burden for the American taxpayer to bear. trillions of dollars for the war in Iraq, but we can't have $16 million a year. And the reason is the techniques that catch terrorist finance movements also catch tax cheats. So it's really important that the general public understand that we can act against this, but our political leaders aren't doing so. And why in the world should we elect to Congress and the Senate representatives who care more about protecting the Sheldon Adelsons and the Apples, avoiding taxes and shifting the burden to us, than about requiring that they participate in paying for the government that makes the society in which they made all this money?
How do you explain this, David, to citizens who, you know, a lot of people are very anti-tax at this point for a variety of reasons?
Well, I think just about everybody hates paying taxes, including me. But what really frosts me is here's Sheldon Adelson, who he has two personal 747s, his and her 747s. And he's engaging in these tax dodges. Why should someone with that kind of money be able to reduce their burden because we're not enforcing the law and we are not making the law appropriately prophylactic, and you and I, Rose, we get fully taxed. This is totally contrary to the principles of a democratic society, and it's outrageous, and it will change when we vote out of office those members on the Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee who are busily working to make sure that the wealthiest among us are taxed more lightly than ordinary people. And remember when I got Donald Trump's tax return back in March, but for the backup tax, the alternative minimum tax that Congress now wants to repeal, Trump would have paid a tax rate on $3 million a week of income of less than 3.5%. The poorest half of Americans, whose average income was not $3 million a week but $300 a week, paid more than 3.5%. We will never get this changed until we elect to office congressmen and congresswomen and senators who say we're here to represent all Americans, not just the political donor class.
Well, and David, you talk about this a lot on the show. I mean, we're talking about Apple. When Tim Cook took over from Steve Jobs, he received compensation of $378 million. $378 million, one of the biggest pay packages on record. They are currently paying their retail manager, Angela Arendts, $73 million a year. I mean, this is how much these people are making. So they have massive money, massive influence in Washington. You know, how do you crack that, David? I mean, at a time when half of U.S. workers make less than 30 grand a year, and these people are bringing in 70 million a year?
Well, I would suggest there are three approaches to take to this, Rose. Number one is shareholders should be upset. It doesn't take that kind of money to motivate executives to do the work that they want done. But we have a rigged game in CEO compensation in particular in this country because CEOs serve on the boards of other companies and scratch each other's backs, and they adopt policies, although you don't see this as much as you used to, that say things like, we pay our executives in the top quartile of all companies. Well, the only way you can do that is if you keep putting, looking at last year's and raising pay to get you out of the bottom three quarters. You still can only get one quarter into the top quartile. So investors should be saying, wait a minute, we don't need to pay you that much money. Jack Welch got $1 billion from General Electric and turned the company into a mess that still hasn't been cleaned up. He would have done the same job for $50 million. Secondly, you got to have unions. When 37% of private production workers belonged to unions in 1973, America was much more prosperous. We had a much better distribution of income for social stability. And corporate executives not only didn't get paid that kind of money, but there are news stories back then about when executives had to lay workers off, they would say, I'm going to work for a dollar a year, or I'm not going to take any pay whatsoever until we hire back these people we've temporarily had to let go. Can you imagine today a CEO saying that? And the third is taxes. The top tax rate currently and what is being proposed in Congress starts at about $500,000 of gross income. why do we not have a tax rate for a million, 2.5 million, 5 million, 10 million, 50 million, 100 million? In 2015, we had roughly 100 people whose salary was more than $50 million, and the average was, I think, 97 million, if I remember the chart correctly, 91 or 97 million. Let's have higher tax rates on these enormous incomes, which have no social utility whatsoever.
Well, Will, you're dealing, I mean, many countries are dealing with these issues. What are your thoughts about the differences between U.S. officials and European officials? Because now there are reports that European Union regulators are asking Apple for details of its tax structures following last year's order to pay back taxes of up to $15 billion to Ireland.
Well, we've seen some European countries, mainly in the European Commission, take some pretty publicly strong moves against Apple, and there's ongoing discussions about a pretty hefty tax bill going on at the moment. You know, after Paradise Papers, even today or yesterday, we saw that members of the European Parliament have called a hearing and an inquiry to learn more about Paradise Papers in a week or two's time. To my knowledge, we haven't seen such a move in the US yet, and it will be interesting to see whether or not, you know, Congress does take explicit action in relation to Paradise Papers, or what will happen. You know, generally my experience as a journalist, for good or for ill, is that European tax authorities are generally much more vocal and outspoken after these kinds of large international tax haven projects. It's very difficult for us at the ICIJ and our partners to get the IRS to talk about what, if anything, they've done. I think about Panama Papers. We're now 18 months or so on from that. We've had well over a dozen European countries release public statements about the number of people that they've arrested, how many cases are currently before the courts, how many tax audits have been opened, and that information is impossible to get from within the United States, at least according to anything I've seen.
According to these documents, 10% of wealth is parked overseas in these tax havens. We have just a couple minutes left, Will, but this is getting so much attention, as David said, really good attention. What are your thoughts about what's next? I mean, what do you think will happen as a result of the publication of these documents?
Well, I think there'll be more stories to come, first of all, even though lots of us have spent 9, 12 months looking through it. This is really complicated stuff, as David and you said earlier. In most cases, we're not talking about emails in which someone with $10 billion explicitly says, please help me hide my cash and avoid paying taxes. We're talking about hundreds or thousands of pages from one company alone setting out in very technical details what's going on. And that information's all entirely meant to be secret. So it requires lots of research, lots of expert help to understand what's happening. So I'd say watch this space for more stories, but I do also think that governments, if they want to act on this, have more than enough material to react. The question is whether or not they will, and whether or not continued investigative reports and public reaction to this leads them to do so.
And, I mean, there's such a machine behind this. We were talking about Applebee, which has clients in all 50 states. But it was interesting to read the article about Applebee and all of the lawyers that are almost competing to get these clients. Can you tell us about that, Will?
That's right. It's a global industry, and it's been the offshore industry, to me, has been described as a whack-a-mole kind of situation. We saw it with Mossack Fonseca in Panama Papers. You hit one, and it puts its head down. Maybe it goes out of business. Maybe it just shrinks a little. But you've got hundreds of competitors, well-moneyed, serious professional competitors who are there just to take up the clientele that will flee. And we saw a report, I think, in the Financial Times today about that, the fact that former Applebee clients may well be already eyeing offshore competitors to keep doing exactly what they've been doing. And that we might just have to wait till the next leak on this subject comes to see where they went and what they kept doing.
And then governments are also involved in this. The BBC actually had a really interesting story yesterday called Paradise Papers, Fishy Smell About Namibian Tax Affairs. And they reported about how the Atlantic Ocean off of the coast there is teeming with fish, but the workers don't see any of the profits from their hard work. The government there signed deals with one of the world's biggest fishing companies, the Hong Kong-based Pacific Andes. And there's just a lot of tax deals that go on behind the scenes that allow these international companies to get most, if not all, of the profits. And some of the local people said that they have to leave the country because they can't make ends meet.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting and I think an important parts of this whole international tax debate. We're not talking about companies and people acting in vacuums. As David said before, governments, including the US, the United Kingdom, and all the tax havens themselves, they make active decisions about introducing laws, about signing treaties with other countries that have real-world effects. When you have a country like Namibia in Africa that signs a tax treaty with a tax haven, say like Mauritius, and under that tax treaty, a company can legitimately, or at least legally, reduce its tax bill, that can really cause genuine problem. It can reduce the overall taxes paid in that country, which means that in a place like Namibia, where every dollar for schools and hospitals counts, you've suddenly got less to go around.
Mm. David, what about this angle? I think this is so important and deserves so much more attention, just quickly.
Well, in less developed countries, corporations are an important source of revenue because they're places you can tax. And the larger wealthy countries need to recognize that and not encourage the movement of money out of those countries in particular into tax havens. Much as it's damaging to the U.S., to a less developed country like Honduras, it's disastrous.
And could we connect this to part of the refugee crisis? I mean, the people on this show at the BBC piece about Namibia said we have to leave. I mean, we cannot feed our families here.
Well, just remember this. The biggest business in the world is tax. If you came here from another planet as a researcher, you'd file a report back home saying people you would think love tax because it's the biggest enterprise in the world, and in fact they hate it. And that's one of the conundrums. Here in Norway, where I am right now above the Arctic Circle, people look upon taxes as a way to facilitate a good life. And we need to have a culture like that if we're going to stop this.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, author of The Making of Donald Trump, founder of the D.C. Report, and Will Fitzgibbon is a reporter with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. You can find videos and many reports about the Paradise Papers at yourcallradio.org. David and Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us.